From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an updated report on how countries in South America and the Caribbean are dealing with the coronavirus. We speak with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, they talk about how some people are, you know, very skilled at taking advantage of opportunities that come along. You know, there's like a pathological class that's positioned that whatever comes down the road, they figure out a way to use it as a weapon and beat the hell out of us with it. And that seems like that's going on in a lot of countries in this hemisphere and around the world.
What strikes me, Don, about the epidemic, and while recognizing that it's a very serious menace to public health, and is how it's been manipulated, and how there's developed a kind of ideology. Even people in normally quite progressive and radical, even radical people, kind of adopt it. You know, that things have to be locked down. Everybody should wear a mask. All that kind of stuff. And in the context where that becomes the accepted norm, and it's much easier for the nefarious powers that be in different parts of Latin America and the Caribbean, as well as obviously in the United States and Canada, to take advantage of the crisis to advance whatever agenda they have. I mean, for example, right. In Bolivia, Telesur, or was it Telesur or no? I think it was a news outlet called No Doubt. And they reported that Patricia Arce, the mayor of, do you remember that mayor in Bolivia that was attacked?
Right.
She was the mayor of a town called Vinto, and she was attacked and had red paint poured all over her, and was abused and maltreated by a mob at the start of the coup against Evo Morales back in October, I think it was. And we have to remember that before the emergency took hold across the region, and Bolivia was going to hold elections in May. You know, that would have been in a couple of weeks.
Right.
And those elections got postponed on the pretext of the COVID-19 crisis. And what's been happening since then is that the de facto government there, the right-wing golpista government, coup government, has been using administrative and legal measures under the cover of the COVID-19 crisis to attack politicians associated with the political party of former President Evo Morales.
Right.
And what happened in this case is Patricia Arce, the mayoress of Vinto, was arrested in the middle of the night, apparently, by armed police, and dragged off to the police station and charged with violating the quarantine.
Right. Sneezing without a permit. I think that kind of manipulation of this is, you know, I mean, you have installed already the architecture of a complete and total police state under these conditions. Forget the merits, you know, for a moment. They're certainly there of dealing with a health crisis, you know, a global health crisis. Obviously, that's something that's extremely important. Nevertheless, it's not lost on the people that would like to have a cop car on every corner watching every person on the block, that once that car's there, you know, they have some work for it to do while it's making sure also that you don't sneeze on your neighbors. And I'm looking at, for example, how long is it going to take before Lula gets picked up by the cops in Brazil and, charged with sneezing or throwing a napkin out his window or some tissue out his window, and is now suddenly disqualified from running for president for two more terms or something. That physical capacity to, you know, to occupy the population is rolled out around the world right now. And I don't think it's ever been like that. And you got to take it into consideration when you look, you know, some people take advantage of things like this. And this is something that's a material, you know, reality at the moment. So how would you, people can take advantage of that in some very ugly ways.
Yeah, no, so that's certainly the case in places like Honduras and El Salvador, for example, where, and the police have been very heavy-handed in applying the various measures that are in place in those countries. There's so many strange things happening in the context of this regional public health menace. And for example, in Brazil, over the last couple of weeks, you've had the country's constitutional president promoting the idea of a military takeover, which is totally weird.
Yep.
You know, and whoever heard of a democratically elected president talking about what a good idea it would be for the military to take over?
Right.
It's just totally bizarre, and I think it has to do with the way the consensus in Brazil has, even on people who aren't great fans of Lula da Silva at all by any means, the elite, the Brazilian elite, and the feeling has tended to move against Bolsonaro, precisely because he's taken the same kind of position as Trump, one of uncertainty and kind of oafishness, really, about, you know, what should be the public policy in response to this tremendous public health crisis. And so, President Bolsonaro's response to that growing tide of feeling that he's kind of going to cause a situation in which large numbers of people are going to people in Brazil are going to die unnecessarily. There's that tide of feeling, and his response to it has been, well, maybe it would be a good idea to have a military takeover, which is just completely bonkers. No, and so, and this whole crisis, the regional health crisis, is throwing up all these kinds of strange contradictions. And, you know, and it's in each country, the contradictions take a different form. In Colombia, it's being the crisis is being used by armed gangs to do business as normal, because people are subject to restrictions in Colombia, it's much easier for the armed gangs in a way to be able to target their victims because everybody's staying at home, or what do you call it in the United States?
Whatever, sheltering isolated, in place. We're socially isolated.
Yeah.
You know, before you go around the region, before you go around the whole region, let me just go back to Brazil for a second, because, you know, you have that situation, okay, and you can see that, you know, that is visible. Bolsonaro, you know, he's having problems with governing in this particular crisis. People are calling him on it, and, you know, he's saying, well, maybe we'd be better off with the military. And it seems like that's an extreme step, but if you look at his path to power, he's really only, you know, a tissue away from being the actual military in power already. They removed the elected president from office. They blocked the person that should have won from being able to run after the most unpopular politician in the country was a caretaker for a year and a half or whatever. And they managed to basically get everybody out of the way to clear a path for this right-wing guy that most people call a fascist. In other words, you know, you'd be hard pressed to have a fig leaf over military rule that was more transparent than Bolsonaro is already. So, in terms of handing it over to the military, what exactly would that entail? They just put a new sign outside his door or something?
Well, yeah, because I think the figure is now that two thirds of his government ministers and officials are actually either military or ex-military.
Right, exactly. So go ahead. So yeah, you're in Colombia.
They just put the sign on the door, you know.
Yeah, right.
No, from constitutional democratically elected president to military dictator, you know.
Right. Right. You get a lot. So, right.
But like you say, and that's very much a kind of, it's in tune with the overall kind of repressive tone of the supposedly protective and defensive measures against the virus.
Right.
Now, in Nicaragua is a country where they haven't done that, and we still have just one active case, and I think 12 people are under observation but have so far tested negative because they had symptoms. So, and here in Nicaragua, there's such a strong contrast between life being practically normal. I mean, here, for example, in our community center with community programs, education programs, on last night, the students started back after the Easter vacation break. And we've got something like 80% attendance.
Wow.
And, you know, so it's so strange for us here in Nicaragua to look at the news from other places, even from next door in El Salvador, and there are a couple of thousand people locked up in quarantine.
Right.
In El Salvador, and in Honduras, and I think I mentioned to you last week, there's a lot of concern about increasing hunger among the general population, and that's also a problem in Colombia, where there are protests taking place because people are saying, "Well, we're going hungry, and what are you going to do about making sure that about guaranteeing our food security?" So there's that also happening,
yeah.
And in the broader regional context, you have Alicia Bárcena, the Secretary General of the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, saying that the coming recession, which is going to affect the whole world, is going to be the worst in Latin America's history.
Yep.
Which is, you know, and that's really saying something.
Because,
you
know, never mind. 5.3% drop in overall economic activity. That's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know what the figures are for the United States. You know, what are the figures for the US?
I don't know, honestly. I don't know, and I don't know if there are any reliable ones. But this is a forecast now, not a measurement. This 5.3, according to the report that you're talking about, it's called Bárcena presented it Tuesday. It's assessing the effects of COVID-19 to plan the recovery. Latin America and the Caribbean had already accumulated almost 7 years of low growth with an average of 0.4% between 2014 and 2019. And then the crisis being experienced this year with an expected drop of minus 5.3% in GDP will be the worst in all of its history. To find a contraction of comparable magnitude, one must go back to the Great Depression of 1930, which was minus 5%, or even further back to 1914. Damn.
Right. And in the same report, and I think we're reading the same report, and
yes.
They reckon that the crash in the region will throw about 30 million more people into poverty. I think that's a gross underestimate.
Maybe, yeah. A lot of people.
And, unemployment is likely to grow to something like 11.5% or 12%, which also is which seems to me quite a ridiculous underestimate.
Yeah.
I mean, given that most of the region depends very, very much on the United States as its main market,
right.
And some countries like Brazil have China as their main market now.
Right.
But the United States remains tremendously important trading partner, and of course, and because much of the Latin American and Caribbean is in effect like they depend on the dollar, even though, you know, I mean, one or two countries actually use the dollar as their currency, like El Salvador does. And I think Michel Chosudovsky pointed out to me, the guy that runs Global Research, and I was talking to him, and he explained to me that even though countries like Nicaragua and other countries have their own currency, and because they're tied to the dollar, and they can't kind of take advantage of the theories. For example, modern money theory suggests that if you have your own currency, the government can never run out of money, yeah. Right? And so, but that's not true for countries whose currency is tied to the currency, like in our currency here in Nicaragua, all the currencies in Central America are tied to the dollar.
Yeah.
And in many ways, that's a bit like the situation of countries in Africa that are in the zone of the African Franc.
Right.
It's the Central African zone that has a version of the franc, and the West African zone that has a version of the franc. Right. But it's all controlled by the Central Bank.
Right.
Not enough attention is paid to that when people are looking at the economics in relation to the European Union. The fact that the European Union via France controls a vast territory economically and financially of Africa is of huge importance to the financial goings on in the European Union.
But
the only reason I mention that is because that's exactly what, if you look at the history of the two regions of Western Central Africa vis-a-vis France and of Central America and the region generally vis-a-vis the United States, you can see the pattern of how that currency dependence cuts the legs out from under any attempt to do something in. And of course, that's why the United States hates Venezuela so much, and why they're doing everything they can to destroy Venezuela, because Venezuela developed a system that was pretty much independent of the dollar, and they were able to engage in economic policies that created really solid stability in the region, completely independently in many ways. Of the dollar, they didn't depend on the dollar to be able to do that. And then when the United States decided to go full bore economic sanctions, military threats, diplomatic state of siege, total media demonization of Venezuela, and they. How long has it taken them now? It's taken them, 20 years? It's taken them 20 years to get to the point where Venezuela is, it's just about surviving.
Yep.
But if you look at that, they weren't able to destroy Cuba.
Right.
So why do they think they'll be able to destroy Venezuela? And we'll see. But that's also one of the reasons why they hate Nicaragua, because Nicaragua, for many years, was able to run, in effect, what was a policy of deficit spending, thanks to funding from the ALBA network, driven by Venezuela's petroleum income.
Right.
And they turned their country around between 2007 and 2012, 2013, just in time to beat what are the effects of the death of Comandante Hugo Chavez and everything that followed from that that we've seen over the last 7 years. And now what's happened is that the United States is applying sanctions not only against Venezuela, but also against Nicaragua, Sorry, Duncan.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I wanted to say, while they're on that, by the way, there's been, you know, it's like a almost a multidimensional, almost like multidimensional in the sense of cosmic, science or something that, for each universe that exists, there's something of Venezuela that's under attack by the United States. Even to the point where not only is it blockaded every which way economically, hostile politically, all kinds of military action picking at the periphery in Colombia and elsewhere, the fleet floating down, the reestablishment of Southcom, all this stuff. You know, it's almost like they also have people on the ground that, like, sneak into public toilets and steal the toilet paper just to exacerbate the problem that faces the people there. It's that deep in terms of the scope of the attack on Venezuela. And yet, you know, the things that they have to look at that generated are things like, they almost brought about a South American currency. They were pretty close to getting that going on. You know, they built all those alternate structures or financed them into some things that were useful. You had a huge chunk of Latin America, 600 million people and, whatever the GDP is of Latin America and the Caribbean, suddenly like not an appendage of the American and European economies, but an actual independent player. Not for nothing, to take a look at how important this currency thing is to the United States and to the other colonial powers. They dragged Gbagbo out. France went back into Cote d'Ivoire after being kicked out of there, okay, as a colonial power. Went back in and dragged the president out at gunpoint. And the essential reason behind that, the reason that they got a guy from the IMF to run a terrorist war against them in the periphery of the country and then run a rigged election against them, was because they were going to do their own currency rather than have it continue to be printed in Paris under the control of the French government. And at the same time that that was happening, Gaddafi and Libya, who had huge gold reserves, started negotiating with several countries there to develop a gold dinar that could ultimately become Africa's own gold-backed currency. And within months, they took out Gbagbo and Gaddafi.
Right. So, yeah, and that's... I don't think what you... I don't think it's possible to underestimate the importance of the U.S. dollar as a neo-colonial tool.
Exactly. It's an essential part of the architecture of colonialism. This is like this is the lingua franca. This is the trade. This is the coin of the realm, literally. This is the coin of the realm.
Right. Yeah. So now, in relation to Venezuela, and as you mentioned to me earlier when we were talking, President Trump has now ordered all U.S. oil companies to stop any activities that they have in Venezuela, and which is strange because I just saw that Chevron had been, I think it was yesterday or maybe over the weekend, I saw that Chevron had been given a waiver to allow them to continue operations in Venezuela. Maybe that was a mistake. No, anyway,
I think that was true, and I think that what's happened is that Trump said, "Oh no." In other words, the waiver was being generated. Let's see. President Trump gradually shut them down. Okay. I guess that's a negotiated put down. This is from Telesur. President Donald Trump's administration Tuesday ordered U.S.-backed multinational oil companies to gradually shut down their activities in Venezuela. Treasury Tuesday issued licenses for U.S. company Chevron, Halliburton, Schlumberger, Baker & Hughes, and Weatherford to operate until December 1, 2020. This extension will only allow them to carry out activities for essential maintenance or reduction of operations, which implies they cannot carry out activities related to drilling, processing, and marketing of crude oil and its derivatives. So, and they've been tamping it down, I guess, since Trump took over last year. They had banned imports of Venezuelan oil. and transactions between the U.S. and Petróleos de Venezuela. So,
yeah, Venezuela is very much a test case of, is there going to be a successful shift towards a global multipolar world order or not?
That's right.
So far, Russia and China have done everything they possibly can to support Venezuela against the economic and military and diplomatic aggression. And I think they'll continue to do that. Going back to the public health, the regional public health crisis as a result of the COVID-19 virus, it's difficult to try and keep everything in perspective, and in terms of how the geopolitics of it all are going to play out.
Yeah, that's true.
For example, if you look at the BRICS framework.
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
Yeah, remember that? Remember the BRICS framework?
Sorry.
That was, I said, remember the BRICS framework? Remember that? That was, you know, not so long ago that was an ascendant construct, and since then they took out Brazil and South America. I mean, and South Africa.
Also South Africa and Brazil, yeah. The Brazil and South Africa and India has always, right. Under, especially under this right-wing, extreme right-wing figure, Modi. And India has kind of been very kind of two-faced about what it intends to do. This regional crisis. And what's going to happen to the United... Nobody really knows what's going to happen to the United States economy. But it's very clear that the Chinese have... Whether they suffer a relapse in terms of the public health crisis, it seems to me is somewhat beside the point. They know what they're going to do to address any continuing public health issues as a result of the COVID-19 virus. And they're going to make sure that their economy of whatever it is, 1.3 billion people? And similarly, the other Asian economies, together with Russia and the Eurasian Economic Union, of which Russia is the driving force. And that is going to continue. That's not going to stop happening. But it's not clear at all whether the United States is going to be a going concern in the way that it has over the last, ever since the Second World War, right? The last 70 years. And so in geopolitical terms, it's not difficult to see that whereas the United States is desperately doing everything it can, and desperation is the right word. It's exactly the right word for what constitutes U.S. foreign policy in Latin America and the Caribbean. They're absolutely desperate. Now, this public health crisis that's come about and the reaction of the right-wing regimes, I think the probability is that there's going to be a historic shift against in public opinion across the region against the right wing because they behaved so pathetically.
Yep. We've been discussing this for years, watching it come around and go around. We're out of time. Thank you for everything, and we'll pick this up next week, Tom. Take it easy.
Okay, John. Thanks a million. Look forward to it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.